Testing, 1, 2, testing. Kirsty Neat and Jeff Mitchell recording Mr. Jerry Reed at Moore's Kipper Yard in Peel on the 20th of September 1995.
It's definitely.
Right, I wonder if first of all you could just introduce yourself.
Yes, I'm Jerry Reed. I live in Peel.
Have you lived in Peel all your life?
Not all my life, no. I originally come from Hull. I worked in the fish trade all my life, starting in Hull, and from there travel the fishings around Great Yarmouth, Lowestoft, and here in the Isle of Man.
When did you first arrive in the Isle of Man?
I worked first in the Isle of Man when I came over on holidays. My mother was a fish worker and I worked with her starting at 12-year-old.
Right. What sort of date was that?
Well, I'm 63 now, so I was born 1932. So if we take 12 onto that, what's that,
1944. So you first came over with your mother. When did you actually move here to work in Moores?
I worked in Moores here 43 years ago. Right. I got married from when I worked in this place, and I know it that well that it was 43 years ago.
Right. So what was your very first job when you started working at Moores?
I was what we call an all-rounder. At that particular time you had to be an all-rounder in a fish yard to be able to do most things, and that's what I was. I'd picked up all experience even before that age through working in kipper yards in Hull, some of the biggest in the country, D.A. McCrae and McConachy's and Stark Brothers. So yes, that's the way I picked everything up. So when I came here and worked for Moores, I could do anything that was to be done.
And how many people worked in the yard at that time?
At that particular time there was 36 of a staff, and 18 of those were women.
Were most of those people from the Isle of Man, or were they from all over?
There was quite a few from the Isle of Man, and also quite a few from Scotland, Hull and Shields.
Right. So what sort of age group of people were working in the factory?
There were people my age, and also people as old as what I am now. The very, very established fish worker, she or he would be used to travelling the fishings, and therefore they were very, very experienced people.
Did people come in straight from school, things like that?
There was occasionally people did come in straight from school, although most of those people only seemed to work the summer months. And at that time it just wasn't for them to stay on in the kipper trade. They had other ideas, and obviously it was just the odd ones that did stay on.
So what made you stay here for such a long time? As you'd been moving around before, why did you stay here?
Well, I got married on the Isle of Man. I married a Manx girl. And I liked the Isle of Man. I liked the work here. And that's the reason I stayed.
Well, that's a bit about how you came to work at Moores. Can you maybe explain the process of kippering from the very beginning, from when the herrings are first delivered to you here in the yard to when they're sort of taken out of the factory? If we start here, if you can explain where we are and what process would happen.
Certainly. Well, here you see the landing here. Obviously, when the lorry loads of herrings come in here, they pull alongside the landing, and it's just to make life easier, because on top of the landing then we've got maybe one or two men that unload the wagon. They either put them on the landing if the lorry's got to go back out and get more, or they can leave them on the lorry and just take them off as they want them and tip them through these doors here. At the other side of that doors there's a concrete bench, and this machine's sat there.
Right. Shall we move inside now? Right, so the herring were delivered through these windows onto the benches. What happened next?
Well, there would be three or four machines lined up along here, and on the edge of the bench here, there would be troughs that the women would have to feed the machines out of those troughs, so that off the bench they used to be pushed into the troughs, put through the machines, and that bench would have to be kept full up all the time because the machines are very speedy these days.
What were the machines doing?
The machines are splitting the herrings, cleaning them. Previous to that, it would be mostly done by hand splitters. But this day and age now, everything is done by a Vsadko machine, or mostly by Vsadko machines.
If we go back to the hand splitting, if we start with that first, where would the hand splitting take place?
Well, possibly on this particular concrete bench. Then there would be other benches put over here, along the wall, in the corner, and around this other corner. And you would probably be looking at as many as 20 or more hand splitters.
Would that be a male or a female task?
Mostly female. Mostly female. And they travelled here to do this work every season from Hull, Scotland and Shields. Of course, we already had a few local hand splitters, but the majority came from those places.
And how many do you reckon they could split per minute?
The good hand splitter, she could cut between 12 and 14 a minute.
And would they be cleaning the herring as well?
Yes, yes, they had to make sure of that. And the way they had to make sure is when they split the herring, they took the gill out and the roe, and then they had to finish off with a scrape of the knife alongside the bone to get rid of the excess blood that was there.
You've got a machine over here.
Yes.
And that's one of the splitting machines.
That's the
right. I wonder if we could go through briefly how the machine works. Right, so this machine was used at a later date for splitting the herrings. Can you explain roughly how it works?
Yes. The girl would be stood at that side of the herrings. There'd be a trough here full of herrings, and obviously she'd be taking them out of the trough, throwing them into a left hand. And then as these clips came round, everything's working and the tabletop goes round, she would then place the tail under that clip so that when she stood there, you'd have a herring's head, all the tail sticking out round here. And then what happens with all this machinery and cogs going round? Round here is three clips, and there are only three clips on these. Now that when at a certain stage this clip comes round to here, that particular clip will open, and then when it passes here, it'll shut, therefore dragging the herring into the machine, lifting everything up as it's going through, guiding it along. Then it goes through a circular cutting knife. By that time, it's opened up to the shape of a kipper. It's got carried round a bit further. Then it comes to what they call the giller. All this is measured from the start of the machine here. Now, when it gets round to the giller, that knows exactly when it's got to throw itself in and take the gills out of the head of the herrings. It goes from the giller further round, and it hits a nylon brush, a circular brush, that again moves in and out at the precise time, cleaning the belly of the herring. After the brush, then there's a pumice stone. The pumice stone again is worked precisely, dropping itself in and cleaning the blood off the bone as it passes it. By that time, that same clip that's dragged it from here all the way around, that process, is back here now. And what happens is, that clip opens up and drops the herring out into a basket here. And that's the end of that process for that machine.
So how many herrings could this machine split?
Approximately 52 per minute.
Right. And once the split herring is dropped into the basket, what happens to it then?
When the basket's full or almost full, it's the pickler's job then to put them in the brine. It's called a pickler because that's the bowl's been known as that name. And in the fish trade, anybody will know that's correct.
Okay, so shall we move over to where the brining tanks would be?
Yes.
So this is where the pickler would work with the brining tank. So can you explain what would happen?
Yes. As you can see along the floor here and the back of the walls, you can see the outline of where the vats were. And they were made of brick and then rendered, and that would be them. They would be about 2.5 feet high. And then each vat would be after be almost filled up to the top, say 8 inches below the top, with clean water. And then in that water we have to add salt, again clean salt, but it was mostly coarse salt we used then. The amount of salt depended on how quickly or easily it was to get it to the right density using a brinometer. For argument's sake, if we put say 5 bags of salt in a vat that size, then when it stirred up, and it, that again was all done by hand, we made a wooden stick and a piece of wood on the end and called it a paddle, and it all had to be churned up until the salt was dissolved. So yeah, when the brinometer was in, it would probably read between 80 and 100%. Now then, they're all ready now for the herring to be put into. So they're taken then from the machines or roundabout, which has already been taken from the machines, and up to as many as 8 baskets can be thrown into each vat. When the herring are thrown into the vat, obviously, they're going to go down with a thump, but then they come to the top immediately because the salt brings them to the top. It's then the pickler's job, and he's a good pickler, like, you know, he takes pride in his work. He'll turn all the top layer of herring over, belly down, and shiny side up, and make little patterns with them if he wants to, you know, just because his hands move very quick. And then he throws a sprinkle of salt over the top, and they then are left in to how long the cure has told him to leave them in. In other words, if there are good, hard herrings, then it would be something like 30 minutes pickling time. If the herring was soft or small, it would obviously have to be less. And at the same time, the oil content has to be taken into consideration. So those things are left to each individual kippercura.
So would there just be one kippercura for a yard like this?
Yes.
And was he in charge of the whole process?
He would lay the law down, like, you know, at that particular time, and say, I want them in for that long, and that's it. And he had to, you know, he had to have his own way because he was the boss.
Right. Were the kippers, were the herrings stirred when they were in the brine tanks?
Yes, when they were first put in, they were stirred up, yeah. It was just with a paddle again, or sometimes with a loose hand and just shake them about to open them up, just to make sure none of them are stuck together.
Right. And the oil content, you're saying that the oil content of the fish determined the amount of time that they were left soaking. What time of year would they be most oily?
July. July is usually the best month for the high oil content. Right. And as the year goes on, obviously, then they lose the oil content when they start to go around to spawn out elsewhere, probably the Douglas Bank or wherever it is to go now. But then they lose the oil content. It makes them very much thinner and very much drier.
So they're left in the brine tanks approximately 30 minutes. Okay. And the pickler would be overseeing that task the whole time.
He will indeed.
Right.
Yes.
Okay, that's fine. Great. Can you just tell me what these channels are for in the floor here? There's similar channels outside in the yard as well.
Yes, certainly. When these machines are going, there's a considerable amount of water going through the machines, and obviously it's got to be carried away somewhere, and it's just a drain. It carries everything down there, and should any excess guts come out the herring, the melt in the roe and things like that, and they escape, then down the grid there is a basket to save all that going down and blocking the drains up. And that's all they're used for, really.
Okay, so taking away all the dirty water bits.
Yes, correct.
Right, so after the herring have been soaking in the brine tubs for 30 minutes, they're then brought over to a trough like this.
Yes.
And what happens then?
This is called a tentering trough. And the herrings are put in here probably two, no more than three baskets at a time. And at each side of the trough then we have two ladies stood there. And then it's their job to take the herrings out of the vat and place them on the two wider hooks, spreading them open, and the belly has to be outwards. In other words, the skin to the back and belly out. And they go along and fill all the hooks up at both sides. Then one of the party on the trough has to take the stick off full of herrings, and then it has to be taken into the smokehouse, put on one of the low rails so that only the one she can reach, obviously. And then she comes back out and just carries on the same procedure. Obviously, there's a lot of these sticks at the side, maybe in racks or whatever. And one of these women on the trough has to keep picking one up and pouring it on. And these women would go like billy-o because they'd be picking handfuls up and just going as quickly as that. And more often than not, the one that was running off, what we call running off, before she could get back, this woman at this side had probably picked one up and put him over at her side, so that she's doing nothing else but running backwards and forwards.
Would there be tentering troughs along each outside each part? Every smoke house would have a tentering trough?
No, not really, no. But what would happen is there would be four, five or six of these tentering troughs spread around, so that all tentering troughs would be filling one house at a time. Because it was vital to try and get a house away as quickly as possible. So in that case, that's what used to happen.
So four troughs would feed one smokehouse?
Yes, then they'd move on to the next smokehouse, yes, correct. Okay. Obviously, these wooden troughs were used then, and the wooden sticks, but now everything's changed for health reasons, and has to be now stainless steel or something else, like fiberglass or whatever, and troughs have to be either stainless steel or fiberglass, and that's the way it is today.
Right. Who would bring the herring over to the trough? Would that be a woman's job as well?
No, that's where the men would come in. The baskets were rather heavy, like, you know, and especially when they were soaking wet, because you get a lot more split herring in a basket than what you would a whole herring. And consequently, no, it was the men's job. Bear in mind now, all this used to be done downstairs at one time. It's only here on this floor here for easier work that it was changed to up here. And they got the herring up through a trapdoor further down the yard over there, and then the men used to wheel these over to the trapdoor and tip them in and wheel them back for the women.
Great. So when the tentering hook is full of split herrings, how would the smokehouses be filled?
Well, again, many years ago, these bottom rails, as you see, there's none there now, but from those bottom rails and the centre rail there, there used to be rails, but there wasn't wooden. They were made of iron, obviously, so the fires wouldn't burn. But they were right down to the ground then. So it was very easy for the women to take this tentering stick full of herring and walk in and just put it on the rail like that across the iron rails. She would probably pull four rails up like that and work her way out until four rails of these would be quite full. And they could be allowed to touch each other because there wasn't going to get smoke there anyhow. And then after that procedure, it was the men's job then. And the way they put these four rails up, high up in the smokehouses, one at the bottom, and when it's full of herrings, it's pretty weighty. He would have to hand it up something like that to stop, not like that, he'd have to hand it up like that to stop the herring tippling right out. And then a man in the middle, he would take it off me, and he would do exactly the same as I've done. He would pass it up to another man at the top of the smokehouse. And then it was he at the top of the smokehouse that used to hang them on the smokehouse rails proper. He would leave them probably 4 inches apart. And this four rails of tight herrings, what we call tight herrings, he would probably get between 6 and 7 rails out of them after he'd split them open 4 inches apart at the top. And then he's going to have a few more put in these then. So what happens is when they've gone up, this other trough's put as many rails in as the hanger asks, because he knows, he's the hanger, he knows how many of these tight rails, say 3 rails tight, he can hang 5 rails up there. And instead of people shouting up and saying, how many rails, how many do you want, like he says, put 3 rail in. So that procedure is done until the smokehouse is completely full at both sides.
So this ground floor level here is really a storage space. The women are loading it up, ready for the rails to be moved up higher for smoking proper.
That's correct.
Right,
yes,
okay,
yes.
Understand that now. So the smokehouse is full. How many herrings would a full smokehouse hold? Could you?
One of these double houses will hold 20,000.
20,000 herrings, right. So what would happen then?
Well, when now that they've been hung and they're ready for smoking, then the first thing that the smoker must do, now, even before the smoker, because this house obviously is going to be filled long before 6 o'clock in the evening, so then it becomes the job of the hanger, more often than not. He then has to make sure that he puts what we call down the first fires. And in order for him to do that, then he has to be very well experienced in his job and know a little about the smoking side of it. But his first job then would be, he would have to check that the traps in the roof of the smokehouse, because they open and shut both sides, and he would have to make sure that he's got them set right in accordance with the flow of the wind. Obviously, if he's got them shut the wrong way and the wind's blowing in, it's going to blow all the smoke out down here. So he's got to know things like that. So having done that, then he lays the fires down in there. He can put as many as 10 in for the start of the procedure. He's got to make sure that they don't burn away too quickly, because if he lets them roar away, then with all these herring being soaking wet that's hung up there, all this heat does is makes the herring steam. And once the steam gets in between the flesh and the skin of the herring, you can forget them, like, they're ruined.
Did that ever happen here?
Yes, quite often happened, like, you know, when, because you sometimes you wouldn't get the same smoker coming to work for you every season. This was people that used to travel from across, used to come as smokers and one thing and another. So yeah, it did happen occasionally. It certainly did happen, and if the fires went too hard after that first fire, then they could be cooked. And the same thing happens again. I mean, even I can cook kippers now, unintentionally. But what really happens is after you've got the first fire done and the second fire set lovely, then you give them a little bit more heat. And sometimes you can't help but cook 2 or 3 sticks, but not 20,000, like.
you wouldn't ruin the whole shed for. Right. I wonder if you could build a fire for us.
Same.
And just talk through what you're putting on the fire and how you're building it.
Yes.
Up. Probably best to stop while you go and get the bits and pieces.
Okay. Crack on now.
Crack on now.
I'll run through the door here.
Yeah.
So you can be sort of facing the door a bit.
Yeah, okay.
And I'll let you.
I'm only going to build these very small, you know, just to let you see. This is what we would do when everything is set. When things are set, then you can give them heat. There'll only be a flare. You know, some people might think they're not worth lighting, but believe me, having already had 3 or 4 sets of fires in, this house is hot now. And that's all you're going to need, like, you know, because there's more heat comes off then than what you would imagine.
What sort of sawdust are you using?
we cannot get pure oak or anything like that. We can get a certain amount, but it's obvious, you know, that with the furniture that's made today, it speaks for itself. You can only get so much, and then we just have to make do with what we can get, like the most hardwood as we possibly can. So I'll just have to get some sawdust on the top of that now. Okay, these are only very small, but they're okay.
So you've got sort of wood chippings on the base and then a bit of sawdust on the top.
Yes, it's more or less half and half. Shut the door. Yes, that should be okay now. I'll shut these doors now and see if we can get them going a bit better. No, I don't. Piece of dust that I put on the back, when these really start to get going and they catch properly, the dust at the back will start rolling down on the front and deaden any excess flame, and obviously creates a lot more smoke as well. But you put your hand there, you can feel that heat already, and there's nothing there. I mean, the house is cold and everything else. I'll just give it a shake up. Force them, and that's just the natural draft that's happening here. But you can see the smoke start to create in there now, and you see the draft now. You see, and that just starts something into heart. But if I did vice versa. The way we're doing that now, with what we call we're driving everything to the back, and that will hit the back of the walls and probably bounce out nearly to halfway this way on the smokehouse. But then again, watch the difference now. When I do this, by rights, if I'm right, when I shut these two doors, the flames in them should jump back a little. Now you see them coming back this way.
Back this way, yeah.
You see them coming. And it's steadied them up now. You see the circulation of the smoke here?
Yeah.
They're getting some smoke in there now. And within half an hour.
It's not coming out here at all, is it? It's just controlled within.
Yeah. And within half an hour now, you'd not be able to see it now. You really wouldn't like it.
Can you stick the camera in to see, have a look up the top?
Yeah.
So how long would the herrings stay in the smokehouse before they were ready?
Before they're ready, well, after the first fire, which is going, let me open that case, after the first fire that's going to open, that's going to last probably 3 hours, then you can take some kippers out. Right. It takes about 2.5 to 3 hours before you get a few sticks. You won't get them all, like, you know. You'll only get a few sticks at the bottom.
The ones lower down.
Right low. That's after the first 2 or 3 hours. But not only is it allowed you to take maybe a dozen sticks out, it's what we call in the trade, it's set the bottom 3 or 4 rows, making them nice and dryish. And that's fine, like, you know. So the next procedure, you take a few more out after the next fire, and the next fire, and the next fire. On the whole, to empty one of these houses from top to bottom when it's full takes roughly about 10 hours. You could empty it in 8 hours, but on the whole, round about 10 hours.
So would there be, what do you call the person who's responsible, a smoker? Would there be a smoker here sort of all through the night?
Yes, they used to start at 6 o'clock in the evening, while 6 o'clock the following morning. And in this place, he'd never be on his own. He'd always have an assistant with him, because there's a lot of work to be done. And obviously, when they're upstairs striking, and that's the term is used for taking them out, when they're striking upstairs, then obviously they can't see what's happening to these fires down below. So then he shouts to his assistant, go down and check them fires, like. And
so the hangar would probably start the fires. Right, and then the smoker would come in at 6 and see them through the night with his assistant. Right, so once the herrings have been in the smokehouses, say for 8 hours sometimes, they're then ready to strike or take out. So what would you do next?
Yes, well, during that 8 hours, obviously, there's got lots got to be taken out in between time. So what we do, we've got to lift these up.
Are they given a proper name, those doors, or are they just smokehouse doors?
They're just smokehouse doors.
Right.
And now obviously, you see, during this period of 8 to 10 hours, we've already shifted some off these rails, you see, here. So now all I've got is about another 3 rail up there to take out. So I've got to drop the traps here, just for my own safety's sake. And then I've got to climb up the rails and get them out, you see. So then, when I've got them, I'm dropping them down on the rails, and then just turn them around, and I take them out, probably 3 in each hand or 2 in each hand.
This is two sticks.
Yeah. Kippers, yeah. And then I just reel them on here, just so the ends of the sticks are touching on there, and it just keeps them all separate. And then these are cooling off then, as the more we put on, like, you know, the later the night's going on. But by the time they're full, it'll be probably they could be filled by about 2 o'clock in the morning, some of them.
So would the smoker take them out of the smokehouse?
Yes, that's
right.
The smoker's job.
Right.
He has to take them out. And all these racks then are full up, ready for the next morning for the women coming to pack them all.
Right, so what time would the women come in?
The women start at 6 o'clock.
Right.
Sometimes they used to start at 5 o'clock. All depending on the day's catch and the day's what they've done through the day.
Right, right. So they come in ready to pack up the herring. How would they pack the herrings?
Then all herrings was packed in 1 stone boxes at that particular time. Now, all right, there's other ways of packing them. But nevertheless, they're still packed into boxes before any more process is done with them in the packing. Even if they've got to be backpacked or anything, they're still put in stone boxes.
Right.
Although these days the cardboard boxes now.
Right. So what sort of boxes did you use?
When we were at this in this yard, like, I'm talking of 40 years ago, it was all wooden boxes. The supplier of the materials to us for the wooden boxes was Kelly Brothers of Kirkmichael. They would get them all measured for us, cutting the lengths, the sides and the bottoms and the ends, parcel them all up in a little wire, maybe 50 in a bundle, and it was a flat pack, and we used to have to nail them all together here.
And what was the name of Moore's stamped on the box?
Moore's names definitely were stamped on the box, yes. Sometimes we used to use a stencil for putting names on the boxes, but Kelly Brothers in Kirkmichael used to do that as well for us here.
Were the kippers wrapped in anything before they were put in the boxes, or they just put straight in?
When these women packed these boxes here, obviously they were taken from here and conveyor belts used or something like that, and then weighed off. But yes, at that particular time, instead of them being vac packed, they were called cellophane wrapped. And what it was just a square piece of cellophane. You used to get the kipper, pair the kipper up, lay it in, roll it, turn the ends over and the ends over, and then you used to have a nice fancy label around like a rosette.
Right.
Sticky at one side, obviously, and the name of the company on it and the firm, and you just used to stick them together. And then they used to be placed back in the one stone boxes, but they looked beautiful. They really did, like, they looked good.
Yeah. So the wooden boxes, were they just nailed together by you?
Yes, the wooden boxes were just nailed together.
Right.
Let me think now. They had 8, 16, 20. They had 24 nails to the box. That was including the lid. And that was a job on its own as well, because all the staff used to have to make them. And that was mostly done on days when there wasn't much herrings
right,
in, or
right.
Instead of giving them a half a day off, they used to all make boxes. And
right, so you'd have some in supply,
yes,
right?
Yes, yes.
Okay. So what would happen to the boxes once they're all packed?
When the boxes are all packed, then obviously they had to be shipped out. And this particular place here, I've put as many as 1,000 stone in the morning on the steamer, along with two of the workers from here, which one of them would be the foreman, which was Jim Coulson, and another worker. And between the three of us, we put 1,000 stone, starting at 8 o'clock in the morning at the boat, and having to get them on for 9 o'clock.
Right, so they would leave Moore's, and you'd carry them out, would you?
No, what we'd do, we'd throw them out through the other door there. There'd be a wagon underneath that landing roof over the other door.
Right.
And what would happen is, one would stand on a landing, and there'd be two of us upstairs literally throwing them out, and the man on the wagon would be catching them and stacking them.
Right.
We'd stack them probably 10 high from end to end on the wagon, and we'd rope it up and away we'd go. And that would also happen in most afternoons as well.
Right, right.
So he would be selling 2,000 stone a day.
Do you know where they went, where most of them went to?
Most of them went to Manchester for Moore's. Most of them went to Manchester, although there was Fleetwood and Liverpool, but the biggest majority went to Manchester.
So what was this door used for here?
This door was used more or less just to get rid of the rubbish that was coming out, the seconds and everything else that was left after the day's work. And we used to get lots of waste, and this was the easiest way of getting it down in a wagon underneath. This is the Old Moore's Kipper Yard, and this is the original yard. It was built between 1881 and 1883.
Right. Smashing.
Very good. Very good.
Guys,
what a wonderful fellow to work with.